And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson.
Indiana's gubernatorial race is sharply divided across policy lines. Republican Mike Braun, Democratic candidate Jennifer McCormick, and Libertarian Donald Rainwater each cast very different visions for the future of the Hoosier State. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith dives into those visions with the three candidates vying to replace current Governor Eric Holcomb.
Republicans have controlled the governor's office for 20 years, but Republican Mike Braun's message isn't necessarily focused on continuity. Rather, Braun says Republicans have become complacent, for instance, on addressing high health care costs.
No one really wants to tackle health care. It's the biggest part of our economy. They write a lot of political checks, all of that. I've got a track record where I can do it, and I'm looking forward to it.
Braun's plan is focused on prevention and wellness, which Democrat Jennifer McCormick notes is a major element of Governor Holcomb's historic public health funding program.
I commend Governor Holcomb and his team. I mean, that has been good for Hoosiers, but it's an expense, but we also need to look at it as an investment. So what is a return on that investment?
Emphasizing bipartisanship, whether by praising Republican-led programs or even adopting GOP policy proposals, is a major part of McCormick's campaign. That makes sense, considering McCormick was a Republican when she served as state superintendent of public instruction. That dynamic works right into Libertarian Donald Rainwater's vision, disrupting the two-party system entirely with a total shift in how government operates.
I see things that are broken.
Take property taxes. All three candidates have plans for providing relief from high property tax bills. McCormick's focuses on relief through state income taxes.
Because we were very concerned about the local level funding. So when you've got schools and libraries and police and fire and parks and the list goes on that are being funded through that, and I talked to enough local leaders, they were like, we can't sustain that.
Braun's puts a much greater burden on local governments.
The bill is mostly about the feature of limiting increases in the future, because that's the complaint that everybody had, is their bills got skewed by things that happened federally that created inflation.
But Rainwater wants state and local governments to fundamentally change their priorities to accommodate a huge reduction in property taxes. A big part of that change, ending tax incentives used to lure big companies to Indiana.
Not, oh, you're taking all our money away from us. No, I'm saying that we should take the money away that you're skimming off the top and giving to corporations at the expense of the citizens.
Rainwater's philosophy of upending the status quo also extends to education.
I don't think that the 150 legislators at 200 West Washington Street should be making education decisions for the children in the state of Indiana. I believe that should be parents, teachers, local school boards. I believe we need to decentralize education in the state of Indiana.
If that philosophy is Rainwater's biggest selling point to voters, McCormick's is likely reproductive rights. She wants Indiana to undo its near total abortion ban.
The fact of the matter is this election's about we're either going to have a governor who trusts women or who does not. I'm the only candidate who has been pregnant, and I've given a live birth, and I understand firsthand the complexities of pregnancy.
Braun waves aside criticism of the ban, calling Indiana a pro-life state. His selling point is his career building a small auto parts distribution business into a multi-million dollar company.
I'm going to try to fertilize the field of entrepreneurs. Remember, I'm a Main Street entrepreneur that was a small business, scraping, just trying to do everything to survive for nearly half the time I ran it.
Much of what decides a state-level race is influenced by national politics, something none of the candidates for governor can control. But what they each hope is that the visions they presented to voters can help them capitalize on whichever ways the political winds shift the race. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Recently, Brandon Smith had an opportunity to sit down with all three candidates for governor here in the Hoosier State. Up first is his conversation with U.S. Senator Mike Braun as they discuss the biggest issues in the open governor's race.
I want to start by talking about the thing that seems to be on a lot of Hoosiers' minds, which is property taxes. You, of course, have released a property tax plan that would see significant reductions in people's bills. But the consequence of that is also that it would potentially drain resources from schools, libraries, fire, and police departments. Can we promise Hoosiers property tax relief without costing local government?
So the bill is mostly about the feature of limiting increases in the future, because that's the complaint that everybody had, is their bills got skewed by things that happened federally that created inflation. Since that was skewed most unreasonably, and homes were, it was just to reset it where it was pre-COVID. And then going forward, it doesn't impact revenue in the sense that it puts a lid on it. It's a template that you're going to have to get at least half of the legislators to agree with.
One of the biggest budget issues the state is going to be grappling with is the Medicaid program. Is there any way to rein in Medicaid spending without cutting services that some Hoosiers are getting already?
The proudest thing I've done in the real world of running a business was when I fixed healthcare with no consultant or advice, rebuild the system on prevention and wellness, give your employees the tools to do it, make them healthcare shoppers and consumers on your scratches and dents, minor stuff, protect them on catastrophic risk from an injury or an illness. Did all of that, cut costs by over 50%. We've not had a premium increase now in 16 years. People think that can't be true. It can be if you're entrepreneurial, you take a little risk. I want to weave that into our own state government's healthcare policies.
An exponential part of education funding of the education budget has been towards private schools.
Yep.
Through the school voucher program. Indiana has near universal voucher eligibility at this point. Would you want to see that expanded? And do we need to have some sort of greater academic accountability standards for those private schools that accept public dollars?
Definitely the latter. And academic standards and accountability for the vast public school system, I think, still has not been fleshed out in a way that it needs to be. I like choice, and I think parents ought to be in the driver's seat, you know, not established education. And students need to have all those options as they navigate from K through 12 so that they're prepared with the right choice of what to do once they're out of high school.
So you think get rid of the income limits on that program entirely?
I'm going to look at what the sweet spot is for maybe enhancing some of the stuff that's worked, but certainly looking for accountability that you're not getting a stipend from the government and you're not performing.
Is Indiana in the right spot on abortion rights?
Republicans finally kind of got what they wanted to come back to the states, and it did get vetted. It got passed by a supermajority. I think Indiana is a pro-life state. I don't think a legislator has lost his or her job on account of it. And if it's not right, you'd have to bring it back up. I think you make an issue out of that when you're maybe afraid to talk about some of the other issues that I think especially national Democrats are weak on. And my question to Jennifer McCormick would be, where do you stack up as a Hoosier Democrat on all the big issues that Democrats espouse above and beyond abortion?
Indiana has never elected governors from the same political party for more than 20 years in a row. And Jennifer McCormick wants to keep it that way, aiming to take back the office for Democrats for the first time since 2004. Here's Brandon Smith with McCormick to discuss the biggest issues in the open governor's race.
I want to start with an issue that seems to be on the top of minds for so many Hoosiers, which is their property tax bills. Mm-hmm. What your approach looks at tax relief, but not necessarily tinkering too much with the property tax system itself. Why did you decide to go that route?
Yeah, so first of all, we tried to take an approach that was bipartisan. So we took some language that had been introduced by Senator Holdman, who I have great respect for. He's Republican. We also took language from Senator Ghidorah, who's a Democrat. And they had really good language with existing fiscals to do it the way we're doing it, looking at it through a different lens, looking at it more through that state lens versus the local, because we were very concerned about the local level funding. So when you've got schools and libraries and police and fire and parks and the list goes on that are being funded through that, and I talked to enough local leaders, they were like, we can't sustain that. So we knew we wanted to give some property tax relief, but also, you know, not hammer the local levels.
Is there any way to rein in the state's Medicaid spending without cutting services that people are already receiving?
No. And what's scary about that, from what I have learned and what I've been told, that, you know, the last budget cycle, there was just such a shortfall in the allocation whether it was miscommunication, mishandling, you know, regardless of the reason why, there was a big lack of dollars there that was needed in that allocation. And then you have over the expenditure of what went up, and you've got the perfect storm for what happened. And so someone needs to be held accountable for such a huge error, because it has impacted services. And some of the changes that have also been made have been extremely hard on families, in addition to being on long waiting lists that are going to take years to address the needs of. It's a financial piece of it. It's a workforce need of it. It's a red tape problem there. The Medicaid fix is going to be very, very difficult, and it's going to be very expensive. But like you mentioned, there are a lot of big ticket items that are going to be gobbling up that budget quickly.
We've seen Mike Braun now saying he wants to make the school choice voucher program universal. Is that the right move for Indiana? And if not, as governor, what realistically can you do when it comes to the voucher program?
As we expand that program, the data shows us it's clearly kids who have already gone to private schools. We're just now funding it. They come from typically a suburban, white, wealthier family. And so when we look at the intent of the program versus what is happening with the program, that gives us pause as well. It's not about getting kids who are at risk out of poor performing schools, or getting kids who went to public schools and it just didn't fit, giving them a different choice. That's not what this is about. It's very interesting how that program is working, but we need to pump the brakes on school choice. We could capture hundreds of millions of dollars a year. The last biennium was very expensive, but in totality, you're looking at $1.6 billion. We cannot sustain that.
You've made women's reproductive rights, the state abortion ban, a central theme. As governor, what can you realistically do to address the concerns that many Hoosiers have about how far that ban has gone?
The fact of the matter is, this election's about, we're either going to have a governor who trusts women or who does not. I'm the only candidate who has been pregnant, and I've given a live birth, and I understand firsthand the complexities of pregnancy. And I don't dismiss, it is a complex issue that people have their own opinions, their own faith beliefs about it, their families have their own opinions, but it is so complex and such a massive decision. That's why we have to trust women. We have to trust healthcare providers, because there is no perfect situation to that complex issue. We need to have choices.
Libertarian Donald Rainwater wants to upend the two-party system here in Indiana and make history as well as a third-party candidate. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith sits down with Rainwater to discuss some of the biggest issues in the open governor's race.
I want to start with something that seems to be on a lot of Hoosiers' minds, and it's certainly been a major issue in the campaigns so far, which is property taxes. How do you address people's property tax bills without struggling or hitting local governments in a way that they're going to struggle in their budgets?
So when somebody says to me, well, your property tax plan is going to reduce the budgets for fire and police, I'm going to say no. The local government's already decided to do that with tax increment financing. What my proposal forces local governments to do is to decide, are we going to fund the necessary functions of local government and take care of the people with the tax dollars that the people are paying, or are we going to continue to give it to economic development, which should be private development, not private development funded with taxpayer dollars?
One of the most growing parts of Indiana's education budget is private school vouchers. We have a near universal program now. Only the very uppermost income limits are barred from getting those dollars. Would you like to see that program expanded further to basically be universal, get rid of the income limits?
I am 100% supportive of not only universal school choice as it's currently defined, but I believe that we need universal school choice that allows parents to find any school option that provides the right environment to maximize that child's positive outcomes, whether it's state accredited or not. I believe we need to decentralize education in the state of Indiana.
So lawmakers are looking ways to curb the exponentially growing cost of Medicaid for the state of Indiana. Is there any way to rein in those costs without cutting services to Hoosiers?
The services that have been promised to Hoosier citizens, the state government made the promise they need to keep it. We have a $1 billion accounting error, but we also have in the last budget about $1 billion of new budget allocation to the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. But to tell these people, well, we made a budget mistake, so we're going to have to cancel this program, but it's okay because the IEDC is going to bring in 1,000 new high-paying tech jobs that you won't be able to do because you've got to stay at home with your child. Morally and ethically reprehensible to me.
We have Indiana's near-total abortion ban. As governor, would you like to see that change? Do you think Indiana's abortion rights are in the correct place?
The current law needs to go through any and all legal challenges that may need to go through the court system, and that the state legislature should listen to the people, and if there are adjustments that need to be made, they should make them. I'm a pro-life libertarian, but I don't believe that one person should make that decision as to what changes should be made within that particular legislation. I believe that that is a very delicate issue, and I'm really tired of politicians using it to get votes.
The race for Indiana Attorney General is more competitive this year than it's been in a long time. Incumbent Republican Todd Rokina is seen by some as vulnerable, and Democrats have poured money and attention into backing their candidate, Destiny Wells. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brendan Smith reports on the dynamics in a race that's getting national attention.
Destiny Wells worked in the Attorney General's office a few years ago under Todd Rokita's predecessor, and she says everyone she served with there has left the office.
There is not one person left in my correctional litigation section who stayed. And you've seen the institutional knowledge walk out the door.
That's been a criticism of Rokita's tenure amid reports that many longtime staffers departed. Wells says turning that around would be a top priority.
There are great reasons to be a government servant in that office, but you have to be proud of why you're there. And, you know, if you're working under somebody like Todd Rokita and you don't even believe in the litigation that you're putting your name on and you're embarrassed if your name is even on the pleadings.
Rokita's campaign did not respond to multiple requests for an interview. Political scientist Laura Merrifield Wilson says controversies surrounding Rokita's first term are why Democrats feel the race is winnable.
So Rokita has, by some measures, overstepped what the attorney general has a constitutional or a legal authority to do. He's obviously butted heads with some members of his party and certainly with plenty of people across the aisle.
Many of the controversies link back to Rokita's legal pursuit of Dr. Caitlin Bernard. Bernard performed an abortion on a 10-year-old rape victim in the midst of the state's debate over a near-total abortion ban. Rokita successfully got the state medical licensing board to fine and reprimand Bernard for speaking to a reporter about the case. But his actions also generated a public reprimand from the Indiana Supreme Court against him and spawned multiple disciplinary investigations. Wells has made that a centerpiece of her campaign, including participating in a fundraiser with Bernard. And she says she would approach the job very differently, even as it would be her duty to defend the state's abortion ban.
What we've seen out of the current attorney general is he's taken his partisan positions and he's used his authorities when it comes to licensing to chill medical care. It is not the attorney general's job to make the situation even more complicated.
So what does Wells see as the job of the attorney general? She says refocusing the office's priorities would include an emphasis on labor issues and workers' rights.
I mean, labor trafficking is one because trafficking is already in the Indiana AG's office, in which they're really not paying attention to. But there's also worker misclass, wage theft, issues that the Department of Labor can't get wrap their arms around completely either, and neither can local prosecutors.
And Wells's positions have attracted some big dollar donations, including from labor groups. But Rokita is still by far the favorite, with a clear financial advantage and some labor endorsements of his own. Wilson says part of the advantage is because the attorney general's race has trouble cutting through political noise.
In the presidential election cycle and so many other things going on, I just don't think the race itself captures the same amount of attention that it would in other circumstances.
Donald Trump is very likely to win Indiana this fall, and Wilson notes Rokita has closely aligned himself with Trump.
In a different state, that might be a liability, and maybe some of his actions and behaviors and headlines would be. But given the state of Indiana and given how many races we have, I would think because it's a presidential election cycle that there will be a lot of people take advantage of the straight ticket option and don't even glance at the name or title when casting their ballot.
Wells ran statewide in 2022 in an unsuccessful bid for Secretary of State. And she says she's learned lessons from that run, including the need to encourage people not to vote straight ticket, which allows them to cast their ballot for one party with the push of a single button. But it's an uphill climb in a campaign for an office Democrats haven't won in nearly three decades. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Again, Rokita's campaign did not respond to multiple requests for an interview.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media.
A large share of Indiana's youth grapple with serious mental health challenges. Nearly half of high school students report experiencing depression, and what were already alarming rates of youth suicide attempts have increased. Behind these numbers are teens struggling in silence, families searching for support, and a lack of resources to meet their critical needs. As mental health concerns reach new levels, it's clear we must act now to protect the future of our children. What is at stake is more than their mental well-being, but their ability to thrive in a world that increasingly feels overwhelming. Indiana Youth President and CEO Tammy Silverman is with us to share her latest column, Mental Health Challenges Among Indiana Youth. Tammy, as always, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tammy, we just recognized World Mental Health Day, and so this month's column is so fitting. Your latest column, addressing mental health challenges among Indiana youth, dives right into it, noting that a large number of Indiana youth contend with serious mental health challenges. Share what you mean by what's at stake regarding youth mental health.
Certainly. You're absolutely right, Dee. Nearly half of Indiana high school students report experiencing depression. And we also know that there continue to be these really alarming rates of youth suicide ideation and attempts. So, you know, what's really at risk for that is that we need to make sure that we're providing those services that can intervene and that can help any youth that is struggling with their mental health. Because we know if we don't do so, it can lead to long-term both emotional and physical health issues. So prolonged poor mental health is linked to increased risk for things such as heart disease, stroke, diabetes, all of those things. So it makes it really important that we're paying attention to early intervention and consistent services.
Tammy, you highlight the 2023 Youth Risk Behavior Survey in your latest column. Can you take a moment to share some of the mental health trends that were found via the survey?
Certainly. Nearly half, so 47% of, again, Indiana students, and these are high school students, report experiencing depression in the past year. So that's pretty consistent with what it's been in the past. At the same time, one-third of Indiana high school students report experiencing what they consider poor mental health most of the time or always. And that's an increase from just a few years ago, from 2021. So it's ticked up. The biggest concern that we see is the fact that suicidal ideation and behavior is continuing to trend up. And we know that because in 2023, nearly one in four Indiana high school students reported having made a plan to commit suicide, and more than one in six, which is right around 15%, report having attempted suicide. Both of those are increases from the prior year.
Those are some sad numbers to hear. Now, Tammy, another thing that I note in your column is that you share disparities in mental health by gender and sexual orientation, at least in part stemming from societal expectations and experiences of discrimination. And that's a lot to unpack. Share with our listening audience what some of the disparities are, as well as why it is important that we do in fact address them.
Yes, again, the same survey, which where we're asking Indiana kids, so they're ones telling us, it's not adults speculating, but the 2023 survey found that female students in Indiana are twice as likely to report poor mental health compared to their male peers. And so that is a trend that's been around for a little while, but it is continuing to be concerning. In addition, students that identify as LGBTQ plus also face disproportionately higher rates of mental health challenges, suicidal thoughts, and suicidal attempts. And so again, the more we know about which kids most need the support and services, the better we can tailor those services.
Yeah, I have to ask you, Tammy, because you do address this in your column. What are some of the barriers to mental health care access that you highlight?
Certainly. Again, the provider ratios, Indiana has done a little bit better. You know, we've gone from 523 to one just a couple of years ago to 500 to one. However, when we look at what the national average is, we are really falling behind. That's 320 to one. So thinking about how when you do identify that there's a need, can you get those services? In fact, the Indiana Department of Public Health reports that 91 of Indiana's 92 counties had a mental health provider shortage. And so we know that, you know, kids may be saying we need some help. The parents and caregivers and family members are also trying to get that help. And more than a quarter of them, 27.6% of Indiana parents reported difficulty both assessing mental health and then getting that mental health for their students and their young people.
So, Tammy, you obviously are the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. And so I have to ask you, what can youth-serving organizations do to help?
Certainly. There are many schools and community groups that are doing a tremendous job right now, playing that kind of early detector role where they're prioritizing having training for themselves and their teams so that they can spot some of those early signs and take action to help young people get the mental health services that they may need. There are some programs that are available, like Youth Mental Health First Aid, which is one that we've had at conferences. We know that many youth-serving professionals across the state have taken that training. It's one of those ways that you equip any adult, any, you know, oftentimes teachers, educators with those skills to help identify so that they can also say, you know, let's intervene. Something feels off here. Let's dive a little deeper into what's going on.
Tammy, so I asked you what our youth serving organizations can do, but I just have to ask you, coming off of the heels of this youth risk behavior survey, what can our elected officials do to help?
That there are a lot of conversations going on right now and continuing those conversations and making sure that when we're talking about our state response and what policies might we be able to put into place to increase that access, that we're not forgetting about youth. I think sometimes with youth, there can be a presumption of, oh, they'll figure it out or they can get through it or whatever those kind of sayings are, you know, just put your head down and keep going kind of thing. Just making sure that we're talking about what a tremendous deal this is for youth across the state of Indiana in all pockets. As we said, all of our counties are facing challenges. So this is something that's not just one particular group or area of the state. It's across the state. So we need to be sure that we're continuing the conversation about services needed while at the same time destigmatizing folks that may be addressing and dealing with a mental health issue right now so they feel comfortable coming forward.
Before I let you go, Tammy, your column concludes with glimmers of hope. Can you share what you mean by that?
Yes, I think we've all heard of the idea of triggers, and those are incidents that kind of really provoke a negative emotional response, right? Those things that bring back a lot of the challenges or negative experiences or adverse childhood experiences that an individual may have. Glimmers are the reverse. They're the opposite of triggers. They're those hopeful perspectives. It is focusing on small moments of joy and safety and connection that really can promote calm and well-being. This is not a substitute for clinical care. However, it is a skill-building mechanism that we can help young people with so that it can also help as they encounter or deal with stress, anxiety, or depression. It kind of gives you that bank of good, positive thoughts and experiences to pull upon when you encounter some of those negative experiences that are inevitable for all young people as they grow up.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Tammy, as always, we thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking, and we cannot wait to have you back with us next month.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Dee.
For over three decades, Indiana Youth Institute has supported the youth services field through innovative trainings, critical data, and capacity-building resources, aiming every effort at increasing the well-being of all children. To learn more about Indiana Youth Institute, visit IYI.org. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. The Federal Reserve interest rate, or FOMC rate, is the interest rate at which banks and credit unions borrow from and lend to each other, and is the benchmark for nearly all interest rates. In mid-September, the Federal Reserve lowered its key interest rate. Ershang Leong is an economist with PNC Financial Services Group, and she joins us now to share what this rate cut will mean for the local, statewide, and national economies. Ershang, as always, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me again, Dee. It's always a pleasure.
Ershang, so the Federal Open Market Committee met in mid-September and cut back the Fed funds rate 50 basis points. What are some updates as well as implications for the U.S. economy?
Yeah, so the start of this rate cutting cycle was largely expected. You know, PNC was forecasting, you know, the Fed's going to cut back interest rate in mid-September, but it was kind of out of expectation that the Fed starts with 50 basis points. We were calling for 25 basis point cut along with the consensus estimate. So, you know, people wonder, was the U.S. economy heading into a recession or not, given, you know, the Fed starts with 50 basis point instead of, you know, 25 basis point cut. PNC still calls for a moderate economic growth, and we see no near-term recession, even though, you know, the risk has elevated the following, you know, the July jobs report and some of the downward revisions from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But still, we are seeing some moderate economic growth this year, as the economic fundamentals right now are still in a good shape. You know, it's important to notice the difference between, you know, the U.S. labor market went from a very tight status into a more balanced status now. And we are actually not changing from a balanced status into a deterioration status. So really, if you look at the labor force participation rate, it's still down from the pre-pandemic peak and, you know, with the early retirement of the baby boomers. And in the past several years, about 4 years, the labor force participation rate is gradually picking up. And the tightness in the U.S. labor market is gradually easing. And we are seeing some cooling in the U.S. labor market. And even though the U.S. is not adding, you know, super hot number of job gains each month, especially after the week July jobs report and some downward revisions on job gains between March 2023 and March 2024, we're still adding jobs this year. So we're not seeing some kind of near-term recession. We're still seeing, you know, still economic growth this year, even though, you know, the economy is going to cool down a bit. And the dot plot released in this FOMC meeting, you know, it is the summary of economic projections from the FOMC participants. Their expectations for the economy and the Fed funds rate shows that the median projected Fed funds rate at the end of this year is 4.4%. So that suggests, you know, another 225 basis point cut at each of the two remaining FOMC meetings this year. So one in early November, another one in mid-December. And this was, in fact, within PNC's expectation. We're seeing another two cuts later this year. And, you know, as we think, you know, the FOMC will continue on to
eases monetary policy in an attempt to avoid some elevated risk of recession. But still, the U.S. economy is still in a good shape, and we're still adding jobs this year, you know, adding at a moderate pace, a more balanced pace compared to in the past several years when, you know, the labor market was very tight. And yeah.
Now, Arshan, can you provide some economic updates for Hoosiers?
Yeah. So we got some GDP updates in the very late of September. So for Indiana, economic growth there actually lagged behind its neighbors, like in Kentucky, in Illinois, in Ohio, and in the north. But it wasn't bad. So economic growth in Indiana wasn't bad. Percent change in real GDP in the second quarter was 2.8%. That is slightly below the 3% nationwide. But still, it is a decent growth, economic growth in Indiana. And the reason that Indiana lagged behind was there was some kind of slower growth in personal income. So personal income was growing slower from its peers, and jobs added in all the states here in the U.S., it is the non-durable goods manufacturing industry. But for some of the manufacturing industry in Indiana, they are durable goods, you know, with the auto plants and there are recreational vehicles manufacturing. There are metals manufacturing industries in Indiana. There are, you know, airplane manufacturing. So non-durable goods manufacturing, which was increasing in all 50 states and also in the District of Columbia, D.C., that was leading sector to growth in many of the states here in the U.S. So Indiana kind of not having that kind of benefit like the rest of the state, and unemployment rate in Indiana was slightly higher than states as well. So we just got the fresh jobs report in August. So there were about 20,000 jobs added in the state, in Indiana. So manufacturing kept losing jobs for the past several months now. So this is not only true for the Hoosiers, but also nationally. Manufacturing employment is still down about 1.5%. person from last year. We see, you know, many other sectors are still adding jobs, especially financial activities, professional and business services, leisure and hospitality and government sectors. So really, consumers are still spending money, probably not on the goods producing industry, but definitely in the services industry, especially under this, you know, still elevated interest rate environment. And the September jobs report for the nation came out today. It was the U.S. economy blew out a large amount, out of surprise number of job gains in September. You know, people may be concerned that the numbers could be overestimated, but the good news is that it wasn't just an employer survey. Unemployment rate from the household survey, that fell to 4.1%. And there were huge, about 430,000 jobs added from the household survey. That was the best month since March. So really, consumers are still gaining some strength from the labor market. You know, average hourly earnings were rising and were up 4.4% in September from a year ago. This is a slight acceleration from wage growth of 3.9% in September and 3.6% in August. So really, consumers are still getting some support, and they keep spending, probably not on the buying goods, but they are definitely, you know, shopping for services, you know, and the U.S. economy will continue to get some support from the labor market as well. As, you know, the saving rate was also revised up. That could hint some, you know, near-term growth in consumer spending as well.
Wow. That's a lot of information. Now, Arshan, before we let you go, I just have to ask you, what are PNC's economic forecasts over the next year?
PNC expects the U.S. economy will continue to grow over the next year, despite some lag effect from the elevated interest rate on the U.S. economy. So I want to make a note here. So monetary policy can be more restrictive, even with no interest rate hike, as inflation has been slowing this year. That means real interest rate, that is the difference between total rate and inflation. So the difference is getting bigger. So real interest rate is getting more restrictive, even with no interest rate hike. But now we had the 50 basis point cut in September. That would definitely bring some relief for some of these sectors that were heavily weighed and relying on credit conditions for the past couple of years. For example, the housing sector, you know, the rate cutting cycle has started. We expect there will be continued effects from elevated interest rates on the labor market, on the housing market. So unemployment rate could go up, but nothing close to the unemployment rate in the COVID recession or the Great Recession. Consumers will still have much savings. And in fact, saving rate was upwardly revised in according to the release in late September. So good news for near-term spending growth that will continue to support businesses. So this positive loops continue to feed in and will likely propel continued growth in the U.S. economy. And the worst of the housing downturn is likely over, you know, with the start of this rate-cutting cycle. So we also got the small business survey. This is a survey done by PNC for over 20 years now. And it shows business optimism is at an all-time high again in the second wave this year in August. So it supports our baseline of a moderate growth this year, despite slowing. But still, there will be some economic growth. So we're going to see some very near-term weakness in probably the housing sector. The U.S. total construction spending drops, so that was dragged by some of the private residential sector. So residential construction spending fell on the month, and well, the non-residential spending were up. So There could be that people were seeing some September rate cut in the funds rate and more interest rate cuts this year. So that have weighed on private construction spending in August, which fell about 2% over the month. And weakness in single-family home building continued in August with a 1.5% drop in spending over the month and a small 0.8% increase over the past year. New multifamily construction spending dropped 0.4%. But as you see, this rate-cutting cycle has started. And we think more rate cuts this year and the next eventually encourage business investment, home sales, consumer spending on durable goods, supporting, you know, home building and some industrial activity as well in 2025.
I was just taking note of all of the great news you shared with us, including the housing market, job growth, small business growth, but also just overall economic growth over the past year. And so we thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking, and we can't wait to have you back with us next month.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me again.
For more information about PNC Financial Services Group, visit www.pnc.com. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. The presidential election historically has had an impact on the markets, both in the weeks leading up to as well as after Election Day. And according to T. Rowe Price, in presidential election years, market volatility was at its highest in the 1 month and 3 months prior to voting day. As another heated election inches closer, Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer believes investors can take steps to protect their portfolio regardless of the political headlines. He is with us today to provide tips on what investors should consider now to prepare their portfolios for any pre- and post-election related volatility. Greg, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
Absolutely, Greg. So, Greg, we mentioned in our intro that in the presidential election years, market volatility was at its highest shortly before and after voting day. We're experiencing this same volatility in real time as both the S&P and NASDAQ saw the worst week of 2024 in the beginning of September. And then 2 weeks later, the market closed at a new high on September 16th. Is this volatility in anticipation of the election?
You know, election years are generally more volatile than non-election years. The volatility can often just be attributed to the fact that the markets despise uncertainty, and elections bring a lot of uncertainty to the country. So in addition to the election, not only the uncertainty of who's going to be in office, there were other factors as well contributing to the market's volatility, the slowing economy, inflation. You know, it's come down a bit, but definitely not to the pre-pandemic levels, and housing and food are still high. And then just the general recession fears, especially last month. The good news is that the market volatility historically tends to settle quickly after a presidential election winner is announced, regardless of the political party that has voted in.
Right. Now, Greg, speaking of the Fed's decision last week to cut interest rates, does this have an impact on market volatility?
Oh, absolutely. The Federal Reserve is often more of an important economic player than the election in terms of the market volatility because of its control over the interest rates. They can have such an immediate impact on the economy and the markets.
Greg, you know, investors can be very reactive to market volatility. You've mentioned previously on the show that emotions are one of the biggest enemies to investing. Why is that?
Well, most investors invest their money into the stock market, planning or hoping to grow their money, not lose it. but it's inevitable that the markets will fluctuate. Even though investors are well aware that there are times when the markets will dip or correct, when they do, it often makes them want to pull their money out of the market. So unfortunately, when investors sell stocks, they potentially miss out on the substantial gains after the market rebounds.
Now, Greg, I can imagine that this is very challenging for investors to stay the course when they see their investments lose value. I'd like to discuss some strategies that an investor can use to prepare for market volatility that will lessen the likelihood of them making an impulsive decision to buy or sell. What is the first strategy that any investor can implement?
Well, to avoid making emotional decisions regarding your investments, one of the things I think is just invest regularly, right? Make it a habit to regularly invest in a specific amount, maybe a specific amount of money, regardless of the market fluctuations. This is what we term dollar cost averaging, and that can help average out the purchase price of the investments while encouraging, investors to stay in the market.
That makes sense. Now, Greg, what are some other strategies that investors can use?
Yep. I think one of the most important things is decide on your appetite for risk. What is your asset allocation? So asset allocation includes, the types of asset classes, meaning stocks versus bonds and cash, that would be included in your portfolio. And the amount of each that you choose to own will be based on your financial goals, your time horizon, and like I mentioned, your risk tolerance. So after you decide, which assets to own, then you can diversify investments. Unfortunately, asset allocation in and of itself will not mitigate the risk completely. So it's crucial to still diversify your investments within your asset classes as well. So for example, when you're owning stocks, it would be recommended to own stocks from different size companies as well as stocks from a variety of sectors like tech or healthcare. When you look at the bond side, you might purchase bonds from more than one issue or try bond laddering. You can also include investments like mutual funds or ETFs that incorporate a pool of investments.
Okay, Greg, but let me ask you, what about individuals who are nearing retirement? What portfolio strategies should they consider implementing to prepare for market volatility?
Yeah, and that's a great question because you need to build your portfolio and invest based on your time horizon. So anyone who is near retirement, let's say spring of 2020, when the pandemic was causing havoc on the stock market, knows what a feeling it is to lose your portfolio and not have the years to make that up. So since no one knows what the markets will do, it's smart to position your investments appropriately for your time horizon, meaning when you'll need to start withdrawing the funds, so we don't want to have the market drop dramatically before that need arises. So the more time you have before retirement, you can own investments with more risk if you have that appetite because you can assume a little bit more of the volatility. Now, of course, that gives you the potential for more growth. That's why you would carry the risk. Whereas, as you tend to get closer to retirement, it's often recommended to move to lower volatility or lower risk investments, even implement some guaranteed instruments, the returns aren't as high, but there's a lot less risk.
Greg, can you give us one more tip for investors of all ages?
Yeah, rebalance your portfolio. It's easy for it to get out of whack. It's wise to review the portfolio on a regular basis, sometimes quarterly, to rebalance or make adjustments to your investments so that you can stay on track to reach your financial goals.
Greg, it'll be interesting to see if the stock market experiences more volatility as the election gets closer and then after the election as well. Before I let you go, do you have any final words for a listening audience?
Investing, in the market is a delicate balance of taking on enough risk, so that you get the benefit of growth, but not so much risk that, you can jeopardize, things and lose a lot of money. So while we are talking today about the recent market volatility related to the election, if you build a solid portfolio, based on a strategy, then it can withstand volatility, whether it's from the election currently or any other major event, right? So it's important to do your homework if you want to do your own investing or talk to a professional to ensure you're implementing appropriate strategies for your financial goals, especially, if you're in that window of 10 years prior or 10 years after retirement where volatility can wreak a lot of havoc on what your retirement income will look like.
Greg Hammer is the president and CEO of Hammer Financial Group. Greg, as always, we thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking, and we can't wait to have you back with us next month.
Thanks so much, Dee. I always enjoy.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guests from Hammer Financial Services Group, Greg Hammer, from Indiana Youth Institute, President and CEO Tammy Silverman, from PNC Financial Services Group, Ershong Leong, and of course, thanks to Brandon Smith with Indiana Public Broadcasting. We'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.